the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
And a very good afternoon. Welcome to the program. Coming up, the Australian citrus industry. Well, it seems it's finally won the war on canker disease that was plaguing growers in the Northern Territory. But we're going to hear that it's no time now to become complacent. And we'll also look at what's happening with the mouse plague. It's all coming up on the program, and of course you can always send us a text here on any of the issues we're talking about. We'd like to hear about what the mouse numbers are like at your place. 0467 922 684 is a number to text me here at the Country Hour. Because agribusiness company Elders took to social media this week asking farmers to name the biggest pest that they're dealing with this autumn, and the answer was mice. There's been some shocking vision, I'm sure you've seen it, emerging from the mouse plague in New South Wales this year, and the numbers are now reportedly on the rise in parts of Victoria, southern New South Wales as well, southern Queensland, and even into South Australia. Agronomist Michaela Mears is based in Coonamble, New South Wales, and says that a lot of farmers are hoping the cold weather will start to reduce the population.
Currently in Coonamble, they have definitely died down compared to what they were. They're not gone by any stretch of the imagination, but they have definitely given us some relief. Yeah, we've been doing a fair bit of baiting over summer, particularly anyone with sorghum crops in. And, yeah, we're doing a little bit of baiting pre-sowing, but they've definitely eased it up compared to what they were.
And what are you hearing from other regions?
We've had a few reports around Narromine that they've lost some fodder crops, mainly oats and a bit of brassica canolas. And I know down south around Deniliquin and Hay, they are currently getting hammered by mice. The pressure's really on them at the moment. They're in the cotton crops down there. They're in the rice paddies, which is, really starting to prove an issue because they can't bait in the rice paddies because of the water. So they can only do perimeter baiting, but it's just not keeping them out. It's not good enough.
As the weather cools down, what's that expected to do to the mice population?
We are hoping with the cooler weather that it's going to take the pressure off up here. But in saying that, the main concern is the amount of hay and straw that we have under sheds and whatnot, is that they're breeding up in there and we're just never going to really kill the population, and once it warms up they're going to come back out and just breed up in the paddocks again. We are hoping that the cool's going to hopefully kill the ones in the burrows and sort of try and break a cycle for us, because there are issues with mice actually going off the zinc phosphide bait. So we just don't want to put too much pressure on the bait and actually turn the mice off it, because it's the only option we've really got in broadacre farming to control them.
And supplies of bait, how's that holding up?
Look, supply-wise, they're doing a really good job. The longest process they've told us is actually sterilising the grain. So they sterilise grain so it doesn't germinate in crop. So that takes quite a while. But as soon as they can basically sterilise it and coat it in the zinc phosphide and get it out the door, it's sold. So they are keeping up, but, there's a couple of weeks' wait at the moment to get product landed.
So you're an agronomist. What is the advice to growers at the moment for those looking to sow in the coming weeks?
Yeah, monitor. Get out on the bike and get out in the paddock. Have a look under stubble, under dead plants. We're finding them burrowing in under roly-poly and milk thistles and under the stubbles and whatnot. Anywhere there's sort of cover for them, they're usually burrowing in under there. Yeah, and do 100-metre counts, basically. So mark out 100 metres, walk along and count all your active burrows. You'll be able to pick them. They'll be fresh dirt dug out. Yeah, and basically count them, and sort of anything above 100 to 150, it's starting to warrant baiting.
Michaela Mears is the agronomist with Elders at Coonamble, and she was speaking there to Matt Brann. You're listening to the Country Hour. There'll probably be some details about that on Landline on the weekend as well, looking at the mouse plague. And we'd like to hear from you about the mouse numbers in your neck of the woods, 0467 922 684. We've already got a text from Dave in Trundle. He says, the cold weather hasn't done anything in Trundle. 15 fell from the ceiling last night, and there were plenty running around outside. Dave's suggesting a $250 mouse voucher is needed to spend $100 on baits and traps every fortnight, says Dave. So that's his idea. And Terry's texted in to say, if two mice get caught in traps and start talking to each other, it's called a Snapchat. That one from Terry in Coonabarabran. At least he's still got a sense of humour. It's 11 minutes past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
And remember, let us know how the mouse numbers are going in your neck of the woods. 0467 922 684. And let's turn our attention to citrus now, because the Australian citrus industry has finally won the war on canker disease that was plaguing growers in the Northern Territory. It's no time, though, to become complacent, according to Citrus Australia CEO Nathan Hancock. He's concerned once international travel ramps up, the industry could come under attack again. Cara Jeffries spoke to Mr. Hancock about the looming threat.
The number one pest for citrus in the world, and not yet in Australia, and we hope never to have it here, is a disease called Hung Long Bing. Some people call it citrus greening. It quite often gets abbreviated to HLB. It's a disease that ultimately will kill the trees. It'll kill backyard trees, and it'll kill trees out in orchards in the production areas. It works in a vector system, so the disease is in the tree, but it gets spread by a little insect called a psyllid. And we don't have, on record at the moment, we don't have psyllids or the HLB disease in Australia, and we are constantly on high alert and surveillance for that particular pest. We just ask the community, when travelling does start occurring again, or for those people that are returning to Australia at the moment, don't bring anything back in with you. Don't bring any plant material. It could be hosting pests and diseases that really put our horticulture industries and our agriculture industries in general under threat. You can see what a pandemic has done to us all. That's the thing that we intensely feel when an exotic incursion happens. That's what our industries are going through on a daily basis, trying to eradicate a pest. And you can see how hard it is to get control of coronavirus in this instance in our community and around the world. Well, that's the sort of pressure that our industries and our farmers come under every time someone does something silly and brings in an exotic pest in their luggage, because you know, they've got some sort of fondness for whatever plant material they've got. It puts a lot of people a lot of livelihoods at risk, a lot of communities at risk. They rely heavily on primary industry out in the regions, out in community towns. And one foolish act of bringing in some fruit or some leaves or some plant material could devastate an industry and many communities across Australia.
And in terms of countries close by to Australia that already have this, what would be the closest country?
Look, to the north of us, you know, Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, you know, just to the north of us, only hundreds of kilometres really, there are a number of pests and diseases that are exotic to Australia. And we have a really great federal-funded project called the Northern Australian Quarantine Strategy. And they do an excellent job of monitoring for exotic fruit flies and exotic pests and diseases through trapping and through building great relationships with the islanders to our north, and working with them to make sure that any pests and diseases that are encroaching can be eradicated before they reach Australia.
You've heard of the impacts that it's had in the United States, is that right, in Florida, that it's had a big impact there?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a thriving industry in Florida that produced millions and millions of boxes of oranges. Many of them went to juice, but that industry has been reduced to about 20% of its earlier production, And that's, you know, that has really rocked that industry. It's basically on its knees. They're looking for alternative crops to grow. And in the conditions that they have, there aren't very many options. And so a lot of those communities have been severely affected by that. It's thought that that material was introduced to Florida through some unthoughtful person bringing in some plant material, and it was released. So this is a disease that will have long-lasting effects on our industry, which we don't have a cure for. We're doing, as Citrus Australia, we're doing what we can to prepare industry and be as prepared as we can to firstly try to eradicate it and then deal with the ramifications should it become established.
Which is not what they want to see happen. That was Citrus Australia CEO Nathan Hancock speaking there to Cara Jeffrey. You're listening to The Country Hour. We've got a few texts coming in. Barbara at Coonabarabran says that she's seeing that the ones they're eating, the ones that are in the traps. So that's a sign they're on the way out. According to the researchers, they say if we start seeing cannibalism in the mice, then they're definitely running out of food. So maybe that's a good sign, Barbara, even though it's horrific. It's good. Maybe it might be a good sign. Lou says the mice have definitely slowed down here in his neck of the woods. When he leaves the dishes out at night for a good clean, they're untouched by morning. Good on you, Lou. 16 minutes past 12, and quite a few texts are coming in on the mice. Steve said on his property at Barradine there are 7,224,000 mice. There you go. He's counted all their legs and divided them by four to get that number, says Steve. So quite a lot of mice still at Steve's place by the sound of things. On the Country Hour, it's 17 past 12.
The Country Hour. On ABC Radio New South Wales.
And some news on wheat. Wheat Quality Australia is urging growers to prepare to sow for their 2021-22 crop, to be aware of recent changes to the wheat variety master list when they're planting. From 2021, 11 varieties will no longer be eligible for milling grade and can only be received into feed segregations. Now, these 11 varieties are Blade, Clearfield, JNZ, Clearfield STL, Pugsley, Tamarin Rock, Binu, LRPB Bullet, Yandanuka, Endure Bumpy and Zippy. So they're no longer, those 11 varieties, no longer eligible for a milling grade and can only be received into feed segregations. Now, these varieties were flagged for removal from the master list when released in September 2018, and their removal will be reflected in the 2021 master list when it's released in August. So if you're preparing to sow those 11 varieties, you might want to think again. 18 minutes past 12. Well, let's turn our attention to Tamworth now. Selling is underway at the moment at the local store sale. A huge yarding of cattle, more than 5,000 head, were registered at the Tamworth Regional Livestock Exchange for the sale today. But if that number had been yarded, it would have been a record. But I understand it's just shy of that number. To get the latest, it's over to Michelle Mawinney, who's the Executive Officer of the Tamworth Livestock Selling Agents Association. And Michelle, we've been hearing a lot about cattle shortages, but there were no shortage of cattle at the Tamworth sale today.
No, look, absolutely not, Michael. We drew for over 5,000 cattle. We've probably got in the low 4,000s. We just don't know where they keep coming from. But just talking to some of the agents, and they're saying, look, the cattle business is alive and well, and people are basically getting very good at moving cattle in and out. And I guess, you know, added to that, the sort of reputation that we have for this sale, people sort of target this and make sure they can get their cattle here for it.
And you're getting cattle from far and wide, I understand, for this sale too.
That's right. We've sort of been drawing from our normal drawing area, you know, the New England, northwest, out west, from across from the coast. We've had quite a few cattle come down from Guyra for this sale that we wouldn't normally have. But once again, it's that recognition of how important this sale is in terms of raising the profile about the region's helicopter. And just the fact that we get the cattle here, we get the buyers here.
And the quality, what are they looking like?
Quality's pretty good. I know one of the agent that opened the sale said it's probably one of the best lineups we've seen for a long time. We've had some good cattle throughout the year, but there's, yeah, some really outstanding cattle here today. The market's pretty strong already. Like, we've cracked $2,000. We've had a pen of 8 to 9 month old Angus weaner steers making 2010 already. and we're sort of only down the first laneway.
That's pretty incredible for those sort of young steers. Now, what I suppose the other thing is, you know, it's about also about the breeding too, isn't it? And they reckon that
absolutely.
They can actually, you know, go ahead with them and move forward into the future with it and make some dollars on that.
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, as I said, you know, it's all about getting cattle in, getting cattle out, you know, and people must have that confidence in the industry to be paying that sort of money, because I can tell you there's plenty of competition on the pens. It's not as if people are holding back.
And plenty of grass around too. The last time I was in Tamworth, it was pretty green.
Yes, we can't believe what a difference it is from, you know, 2 years ago, and it's just such a nice change for everybody.
Now, you've also got someone there with you from Westpac. Maybe we can you can introduce them and hand the phone over. We can have a chat.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got Daniel Gillette here from the Westpac Rescue Helicopter Service, who we're helping to raise funds for today. And so I'll pass you over to Daniel to have a bit of a chat to him.
Daniel, thanks for joining us on the program as well. And obviously this sale means a lot to your organisation, this charity event as well.
It's a fantastic show of support from the community out here. They know how important the helicopter service is, and we really feel that. I was speaking earlier today with one of the vendors who's selling some cattle and donating the proceeds to us because we transported his son a few months ago. And we know that everybody out here gives us such incredible support. This day is certainly representative of that.
And it's not just about the Tamworth region. Right across the state, the helicopters, if you have an accident, a heart attack or some sort of farm accident or a sporting accident, they need the helicopter there and it saves lives.
That's exactly right. We operate 4 aircraft across 3 bases out of Newcastle, Tamworth and Lismore, and we're ready to respond 24 hours a day. And really, we can't do that without the community support. We've always been a charity, an organisation that started with volunteers, and we've grown to support the aeromedical transport right across northern New South Wales.
So you've got some corporate sponsorship as well, but how vital are these things like these sales to keep the funds going, to keep the helicopters in the air?
Oh, we couldn't do it without the community support, Michael. Every dollar makes a difference, and we're really proud of that. We do have support from amazing corporate sponsors, but I tell you what, there's a great feeling when that cattle goes under the hammer and we know that it's coming our way. We love seeing that support from everybody, whether it's $1 or $1 million. We're happy to take it. We need every bit we can get.
And how much do you think this sale will raise for the helicopters today?
Well, cattle prices are great. I don't know exactly how many are coming through our way, but I'm expecting this to be the biggest sale that we've had for several years. It's fantastic to see.
And the cattle, how are they looking?
Oh, they're in pretty good touch, I think, especially some of the little Angus calves that are getting around there. I think they're pretty good, and look, I'm no expert. I know a bit more about helicopters than I do about cattle, but I think if I was selling here today, I'd be pretty proud of what I'd done.
Okay, well, all the best in the future. Thanks for that.
Good on you. Thanks, Michael.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
And we're getting a few texts still on the mice. Noel at Coonabarabran says the black kites, those sort of medium-sized birds of prey that are pretty common around the place, he says they're getting the mice. And as he's ploughing the field, that's what they're doing. They're swooping down and grabbing the mice. Also, Ed, similar tale, says Ed, he's ploughing through some stubble at the moment. He says the crows are chasing the mice as well. But someone else is not a fan of the idea of getting a voucher for mice baits. It's surprised at the things that people ask government grants for. So that one's come through as well. You can still send us a text and let us know about the mouse numbers as well. 0467 922 684. That's the number to text me here at the Country Hour. Well, of course, as we know, this Sunday, millions of Australians will pause to commemorate our servicemen and women at ceremonies across the nation. But for some communities, the day takes on an extra special meaning. Across Australia, there are soldier settlements, towns that were founded where returned diggers and their families came after the war. Now, this Anzac Day landline is going to focus on the stories of some of these towns, including North Queensland's Ayrish, the town Ayrish, which is a sugar town that was founded on the blood, sweat and tears of returned First World War soldiers. David Benn told Tom Major that his dad Percy was one of the 72 original settlers to carve out a new life as a cane grower.
He came up here, he found his way down to Silkwood on the train, and I've got it written inside in black and white where he had his bit of a story that he was telling to the Preservation Society or the Historical Society in Innisfail, and he walked from Silkwood to Ellerish and he wanted to know where his block was that he had drawn out of the ballot. So he made his way through the scrub and he found the property that he had picked out. It was all hard yakka with hen material, axes, K-knives, mattocks, you name it, and that's what we were working with back then, in the 40s and 50s.
You mentioned that your father, Percy, never really spoke about the war. Do you think that there was a lot of trauma in his mind about what had happened?
Yes, I do. Dad's war medals were sent to that address and they were returned to Canberra because Dad did not want his medals. He sort of hated the war. What upset him that much, I don't know. But all I can do is guess what would have happened over there with young soldiers dying right beside you, etc., etc. So that must have upset him that much. He didn't want his war medals. His medals are still in Canberra, and I'm the only one alive today that can get them. I'm going to leave them there because that was his wish.
The process of coming to Moriah Creek, now Ellerish, and becoming a farmer, do you think it helped him heal some of those wounds in his mind from the Western Front?
Oh, yes, I do, because he got involved with the RSL, Returned Soldiers League, here. Anzac Day used to be a real big one. Yes, I do think that he got a little bit of an easing off of what he brought home from France.
That was David Benn, who is the son of an original soldier settler at Ellerish, 82 years of age, Mr. Benn. Mari Carman is caretaker of the local Diggers Museum at Ellerish, which is dedicated to preserving the town's heritage. And she says despite some sadness and tragedy that accompanied the start of the Moriah Creek soldier settlement, those who managed to stick it out had the luck of strong commodity prices for sugar to help establish themselves and their families in their new home.
We had settlers who were Russian immigrants who had just come to Australia and just before war broke out and went to war as Australian AIF. But they were mostly Australians from Victoria and New South Wales and Queensland.
Your grandfather's story, just how long did he take to, I guess, establish himself as a cane farmer and pay his farm off?
It would have been 5 or 6 years, and then probably by 10 years or perhaps a little bit more, he went on to buy another farm. The impression we get is that they paid their farms off within 5, 6, 10 years. So then I think the price of cane must have been fairly good, because then they seemed to be able to progress and go from horses to tractors. My grandfather had his sons on the farm with him after they finished school. So then they could sort of afford, they had the labour to afford to have more farms. I think by his passing in the mid-1940s, I think they were fairly well set up. They were given a loan. They weren't given the land outright. So they did have to make a go of it to be successful. And a lot of people didn't make a go of it and just weren't either farmers or were just too ill from the effects of the war. You know, one particular farmer was killed fighting a fire, and it meant that his family eventually had to move off the farm. And one of our other cane farming families, they were brought from Somerset Dam to a settlement here called the Clump Point Lands in the mid-1930s, and within a few years Dad had had a typhus tick and had passed away. And that was very sad too.
That's Marie Carmen from the Al Irish Diggers Museum, ending that report from Tom Major. And you can see more about Anzac Day and that little town. Of course, a soldier settlement, that one on Landline on ABC TV this Sunday. Still on the mice, still getting some text through on that. You can always send us a text, let us know what's happening, 0467 922 684. We're hearing about some of those black kites coming down and sweeping up the mice, and also the crows chasing them through the paddocks as well. Mary's asked a question, are the snakes having a field day with the mice at the moment? That was a report we were getting, that the snake numbers were definitely increasing because they were going after the mice. And Ross at Coonabarabran says that the mice at his place, they ate a hole in the gauze outside his window to let themselves in, and now he has to keep the window shut. That one from Ross. So let us know. Give us your mouse story, 0467 922 684, because we're hearing that the numbers are increasing, not just here in New South Wales, but down south the Riverina, Victoria, South Australia, parts of Queensland as well. It's coming up to 29 minutes to one. It's time to get some news headlines now from Adam Story. Good afternoon.
I've heard of those mice eating through plastic buckets to get to food.
They eat through anything.
They're adapting, aren't they, to the suburban
and
mice.
And the smell as well, when there's so many of them. Gee whiz. I've lived through a couple of mouse plagues. The last one that was really bad, I remember, was the early 80s. They were everywhere. Yeah. It was in South Australia. They were everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Still have nightmares. Wake up in cold sweats. Okay, two Australian warships are going to join the search for a missing Indonesian submarine that's disappeared near Bali with 53 crew on board. HMAS Ballarat and HMAS Sirius have both been diverted from separate regional deployments after Indonesia formally accepted Australia's offer to assist with the search effort. The federal government says more flights from India to Australia could be slashed to prevent the hotel quarantine system from being overwhelmed. National Cabinet yesterday agreed to reduce passenger numbers on chartered and commercial flights from India by 30% after India recorded more than 314,000 COVID cases in a single day. The government has conceded a backlog of compensation claims submitted by veterans is unacceptable. 300 employees at the Department of Veterans Affairs have sent a letter to the Prime Minister calling on the government to address inadequate staffing levels. And an obituary today, the former Bay City Rollers frontman Les McKeon has died at the age of 65. He fronted the band during its most successful period in the 1970s, with hits such as I Only Want to Be With You and Bye Bye Baby, and of course, Shang-a-Lang.
The memories. The tartans.
The vinyl's going to be coming out tonight at the Condon household.
That's right. Yeah.
Tartan.
I doubt it. Yeah. I tell you, the outfits, but nearly as big as the Beatles. They sold 100 million records.
A lot of those British bands that just had these massive record sales.
Amazing. Yeah. Just incredible. Yeah. Yeah. But, so the end of the Bay City Rollers.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't know. A bit before my time, Mike.
Oh, yeah, rightio. Okay. Pull the other one. Yeah, all right, have a good weekend. The Bay City Rollers, your place. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 27 minutes to one. It's time to find out what's happening with the weather details. Yuan Park at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mike.
So no real rain on the way for quite a few days, really.
That's right. Yes, it's because of the influence of the high pressure system over the Bight, extending richly across the state. And this high pressure system will be moving very slowly and maybe tracking down to the east to the Tasman Sea by about midweek next week. That means this high will be crawling across the states. That means benign weather conditions and generally dry weather conditions as well, maybe apart from some cloud about the southern inland region. And the chilly frosty morning for tomorrow and during the weekend into early next week as well. So expected chilly morning, especially on Anzac Day dawn services.
So really chilly, like frosty conditions. What sort of temperatures might we see and whereabouts, what parts of the state will be really cool?
Yes, you expect close to 0 degrees or sub-zero temperatures, mainly about the ranges and the tablelands and the western slopes. And this morning, we have seen Canberra's minimum temperatures to about 0.5 degrees, I think. You expect similar conditions for the next few days as well. I mean, to give you some figures, looks like Cooma this morning had about minus 4 degrees and Armidale about minus 1 or 2 and Bathurst about minus 2 as well. So, I mean, some parts, you know, could be staying slightly above 0 degrees, and the other parts over the tablelands and slopes may be, you know, dropping down slightly below 0 degrees, but not really, well, but no more than that, I guess. And it looks like such a minimum temperatures would be staying like this for the next few days.
Right, okay, so, and no sign of any rain really in 7 days, well, maybe some coastal showers, that's about it.
Yes, well, as the high pressure system moves east and reaching Tasman Sea by sometime early next week or early or middle part of next week, the winds might be become southerly along the coast from early new week. That means along the northern half of the coast, we may see a development of a shower or two, and by about midweek next week, we may see a bit more showers. Few showers, mainly about the northern half of the coast and extending into the adjacent ranges, but that will be that will not be until the middle part of next week.
Right, okay, and yes, doesn't sound like there's much rain in the way at all. And but what about the temperatures? Fine conditions, but still cool during the day.
Yes, cool during the day, and as for the maximum temperatures, it will be about mid to high teens over the mountains and staying about low 20s about the coastal and the inland regions, and it looks like a similar temperature, the temperature remaining similar for the outlook days as well.
Okay, Juan, thanks for that.
Yeah, my pleasure.
It's coming up to 23 minutes to one.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
And just got a few texts coming through on the mice. John at Galaganbone says the mice at his place have done a wonderful job cleaning up the summer grass and anything that was thrown out the back of the header. He says, I believe this is worth investigating. He thinks that the mice have been gone about 3 weeks now. Jeff says the last time there were a few mice about, he supposed it was sometime in the 90s, every steel post would have had a mouse skid draped over the top of it each morning, and ours would catch them at night and consume them on a post, leaving the remains of them there. Pretty gruesome tale there from Jeff. And yeah, there's a few more mouse stories coming through as well. You can send us a text, 0467 922 684. That's a number to text me here at the Country Hour. Well, is there a more Australian way of hatching a business deal than over a barbecue? Well, that's how emu farmer Ian Marston from The Rock in southern New South Wales convinced his local butcher, Tim Driscoll, to get on board with selling meat from his birds. He's got quite a few emus. Cara Jeffrey caught up with the butcher and farmer to find out a little bit more.
One afternoon, Ian and Marilyn gave me a phone call and wanted to come up and have a barbecue, a bit of a chat about the prospect of selling emu meat through local here and throughout Australia. Just tried a bit of steak up there one day, and yeah, I loved it since then, and I eat it once a week. And being a small shop in country town, I thought what a great opportunity.
And what does emu meat taste like? Best to ask the butcher, Tim Driscoll.
I'd say it tastes a bit like rump, in between rump and probably duck. It is a darker, redder looking meat, but yeah, that's just the good protein that's in it.
Ian Marston agrees it's best served as a rump.
I think it's best tasted as a rump, and more beef than lamb. It's got a little bit of a gamey tang, which adds a bit of flavour to it. It is very, very tender, and it's healthy. The high in protein, high in iron, it's lean, because I've got all the fat. There's not a skerrick of fat on, I can guarantee you that.
As for cooking emu meat, Mr Driscoll prefers it a certain way.
Just medium rare. Yeah, I just cook it on a barbecue with a bit of salt, sea salt on top. Yeah, I like the flavouring, and I like the fact that it's good for you.
Ian Marston has been farming emus for 30 years and runs 750 emus on his farm Morocco near the Rock. To test the market's taste for emu meat, the pair decided to process 100 birds at a Victorian abattoir. Given the Rock is centred in prime lamb and beef grazing country, changing the taste buds of the butchery's customers was a challenge.
There are customers that live in the town that come in and buy it. Kebabs, I suppose they're a lot easier, easier to cook. People don't really know how to cook it as yet, whereas kebabs is pretty general, you just turn them. But yeah, no, I've had to tell people how to cook steak. Yeah, medium rare is definitely the way to go. They tried it and they've come back and bought it again since, so it's slowly taken off there.
The market for the emu meat has also taken flight beyond the Rock.
And we do supply a restaurant down in Norbury. They've been selling a heap of kebabs down there.
And while kangaroo meat has been widely accepted by consumers, there has been more resistance to emu meat being added to the menu. They're also working to change the stigma towards eating part of the Commonwealth coat of arms.
To Australians, it's fairly new. I was there in the abattoir in 95 and they were exporting it overseas, no problems. So overseas are quite used to it. We didn't do any domestic markets at all in Australia, so it was all overseas. So we didn't push the market because of that stigma where people think, oh, it's an emu, I'm not going to eat emu, oh, yuck. But it's a very nice meat and very tender and very healthy.
As the fat is kept for the lucrative emu oil market when it's processed at the abattoir, the meat is very lean, according to Mr. Driscoll. It's also a cheaper cut compared to beef and lamb.
They don't weigh much, so yeah, you're not spending $20 for a bit of steak or anything like that.
Teaming up with the local butchery means Ian Marston now has a new market for his birds. In the past, his emus were highly sought after for the oil for its immune-boosting properties, while the feathers and eggs were also in demand. He's now found that he can also process the birds at 18 months of age when the meat was more tender, instead of 30 to 40 months like he had in the past.
It is it's a value add, so it's something that wasn't there before, or we didn't push because it was older meat. But now it's not nice and young and tender.
February is the ideal time to process the birds when they weigh about 50 kilograms live.
From February onwards, they start mating up and starting to get their territories and start arguing with one another in the paddocks. So they start to lose weight. So February is probably the optimum time to process the birds at 18 months old. The emus with this 18 month old, I've got to get their muscle groups up first, so you've got to feed them a certain type to get their muscle tones up, because they only got little legs. So if you get them too fat too early, they'll end up splaying their legs, and then it's wasted grain, wasted time and effort. Emus, a lot of people don't realise that they do graze. I run them on lucerne and rye grass, etc. But the lucerne is, they love the lucerne, so that supplements the grain.
The best cuts of meat come from the bird's rear, and there is no breast meat.
The chest upwards, there's nothing that we can use there, so you don't have breast meat or you don't have chicken wings, or you could, but they're not very big. So the main thing is the butt that we use, and out of that is where the 8 to 9 kilos comes from.
And so the legs would be pretty lean, there wouldn't be too much there to work with?
They're very lean. The legs are like the sausage meat and the trim.
The pair have plans to go big with the birds. While Mr. Driscoll has already been selling the meat to customers in New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia, he's also in talks with small goods makers in Western Australia and Queensland.
I like to give anything a crack and I believe it can take off.
And to keep up demand to the butcher, Mr. Marston is calling on three of his fellow emu farmers in Victoria to boost supply.
We have one that's new in the market. We had one that's been in about 10 years. Unfortunately, this year, bird flu went through Victoria and he had to euthanise 3,000 emus. But next year he's got 3,000 that are available and all young. So it'll be interesting to see how the market grows and what's going to happen on here and how quickly Tim can do extensions if it does work.
Emu farmer Ian Marston from the Rock in the Riverina ending that report from Cara Jeffrey.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
On the mouse plague, we've got a text in saying the mouse at their place, they ate through the plastic trap after 2 days of being unattended, so the lesson from that is to always check daily. Well, from the mouse plague to dung beetles, they're the quiet heroes of many livestock farming enterprises, turning over tons of animal waste into the soil every day. But in the Central West, once the cold months hit, many of the introduced species that are best equipped to deal with cattle poo in particular stop working. Now, in partnership with local farmers, Landcare and the Cowra Men's Shed, they're hoping to address that problem. Reporter Molly Gorman spoke with Mid-Lachlan Landcare's Tracy Burke.
Today we are visiting the Cowra Men's Shed. The guys are building us some wonderful dung beetle nurseries.
What is a dung beetle nursery?
Dung beetle nursery is a cage that we can put dung beetles into so that they can breed. And they go onto farms around our region and the farmers will feed them a couple of times a week. And the idea is to breed up a species of dung beetle called the Bubus bison. And it's a winter active dung beetle, and there's a few of them in our region, but we would like to have some more because they create huge benefits for our farms.
Why haven't they been successful in the past? Like, why do we need to be breeding them?
We have over 500 native dung beetles in Australia, but of those, they've never really evolved to deal with cattle dung, the big cattle dung. So over the years, they've introduced 23 different species of dung beetle into Australia from other places around the world, and these guys do a really good job on the cattle dung, but often they might establish in a pocket somewhere in Australia, and so they need a bit of help to establish in other places, and it depends on climate, all sorts of things. So we were able to last year, farmers around the region, we put out the call to see if anybody could find the Bubus bison dung beetle on their farms, and we found four properties that have them, so we know that they can survive here, so it's really worthwhile trying to breed them up and get them to establish.
So what's the process? Once the nursery is finished, what are you going to be doing with them?
So the nursery gets finished and we're going out to put them on farm. So there'll be two nurseries on each farm, and the farmers will have collected some cattle dung to be able to feed the beetle. And these, because they're winter active, so pretty much throughout this winter they'll be feeding them, and if they're getting fed effectively and they're happy, they will then bury down into the ground, and these beetles can bury down up to 500 millimetres into the ground, which is quite a long way, half a metre, so great benefits for the soil. And they'll lay their eggs down there, and then the young will stay under there until they're ready to hatch next autumn. And so hopefully having some in there, they'll breed, they'll establish in the climate and in that on that farm, and so when the farmers open the cage door next autumn to winter, those dung beetles will be able to fly off and be able to settle on the farm.
The nurseries are 1 metre square, about 20 centimetres high, and have a hinging meshed lid that can be easily opened when it's feed time. Initially, the plan was for the participating farmers to make their own nurseries, but the Cowra Men's Shed offered to help out and are using reclaimed timber to do it. Peter Bowler is one of the members who's helping out.
We mainly collect pallets, old pallets. They can be 12 foot long or 3 foot long. We break them down to the size that we require for these boxes. The lid is a slightly different size to the sides. So that's how we just collect them from the various businesses around town that don't want the timber.
So recycling?
For recycling, yes, for sure.
What's it been like? Has it been enjoyable working on these?
Well, it has been, because we've never made these before, and there's a little bit of technical things you've got to know. you've got to be able to cut a mitre and successfully join that together.
There's a practical reason for the nurseries.
By introducing the nursery first, you have a much more higher chance of them surviving, because you can buy a colony, bring it to your farm and open the lid and let them go. But what often happens is they just go and you never see them again. So hopefully this way we'll establish them and they'll settle on to, you know, be happy where they are and settle in.
So it's really... It's just another type of livestock farming, it sounds like.
Certainly is. That's what we're thinking. We're adding a new type of livestock into our farm, a dung beetle. But the benefits can be huge. And there's lots and lots of species around, and there's lots of species that work in different times of the year. So these ones are winter active. Around this region, we seem to have a real lot of summer active species, so they're doing a really great job of looking after the cattle dung in the summer here. But yeah, there was definitely this gap in the winter, so hopefully it'll help and, you know, we'll have some new livestock to look after.
The nurseries are set to be delivered to farmers next month, and the beetles are expected to arrive not long after. Men's Shed member Peter Bowler sums up the practical benefits.
And what do you think of the project, the idea of these dung beetle nurseries?
I think the dung beetle nurseries are a brilliant idea because it's going to improve the soil, it's going to keep the flies from multiplying because the dung beetles will eat the manure before the flies get to it. So I think it's a great project all around.
Peter Bowler from the Cowra Men's Shed. Any of that report by Molly Gorman.
You're with Michael Condon for the New South Wales Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, Australia Post has backflipped on its decision to cease carrying perishable items in a move that's been welcomed by farmers reliant on that service. Producers were shocked when Australia Post announced it would no longer allow meats, seafood, eggs or frozen meals to be sent in the mail because of food safety and regulations. The Australian Small Business Ombudsman has been called in to develop a long-term fix. Northern Tasmanian salmon farm owner Ben Piker sends about $100,000 worth of hot smoked salmon and spices through the mail, and he says talk of that cut-off caused him a lot of stress.
Common sense has prevailed, or logic. It's great. It's really good news.
How have you been feeling this week, having that date of June 30 looming over your head?
Well, I mean, as I suspect most of the businesses that use that service would have been feeling, kind of uncertain. You know, I have customers that want product and they've been asking, oh, can I, can't I, how do we do this, what will we do in the future? And I mean, I've been having some conversations with other suppliers of freight to look at potential solutions. But I mean, I've been doing pretty much the same as everyone else, just trying to deal with the damage, deal with the fallout, basically go into, you know, recovery mode to sort of try and see if there's a possibility of replacing that system with anything else. That's what we've been doing. That's what we've been doing for the past, well, when did we find this out? We found it out at early March, since then.
The acting CEO of Australia Post says that they're going to, quote, develop a long-term solution and a sustainable solution to support this growing e-commerce industry. What's your reaction to that, firstly?
Well, I mean, that's great. In conversations that we and other businesses have had with Australia Post, that's pretty much what we suggested that they ought to do. They need to sort of future-proof their system. And that doesn't just mean continue doing what they're doing. That actually means to go above and beyond what they're doing and improve it, because it is the basic way of the future that, you know, like, I mean, more people are going to order online, more people are going to want more stuff, and more people are going to move into rural settings, maybe out of the cities, maybe working from home, and then you're going to need these facilities because people are not going to necessarily want to go in to big city centres or shops or whatever in the future, and therefore that facility needs to, you know, be grown and improved. Like, I mean, in the future, who knows, maybe there will be a perishable freight system that's implemented, you know, and that'd be fantastic. That probably is one of the things down the track that will have to come into place through necessity. But for now, I mean, I think that's what they should be doing.
You and some of your fellow colleagues in the business community had a meeting with Australia Post and suggested that there was a 12-month reprieve mm-hmm. on this announcement. How long ago did you have that meeting?
A couple of weeks. Yeah, I think maybe 2 weeks ago.
Do you feel as though you were listened to, or do you feel as though Australia Post listened to the media?
Oh, that's a tough one. Before the meeting, there was no information, I suppose you could say, regarding what even the guidelines were for this decision. And that was with media pressure and all that sort of stuff. When they announced it, I think we, 41 South, were on the radio or the telly even, I'm not sure, talking about this exact issue and how it affected us. And up until we had that meeting, nothing really changed, and that was a few weeks in between. And then after we had that meeting, we stated our case quite, you know, frankly, to say, look, this is a multi-million dollar business opportunity that's going down the toilet. You've got to, you know, for lack of a better word, pull your finger out and fix it. because it's needed to. So I would like to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that it wasn't a sort of media pressure, although it would have definitely helped. However, I can't say that with certainty, obviously.
So, Ben, any final words?
Yay, happy days. So, I mean, at the end of the day, it's still inevitable that something needs to change. So we'll see what happens in the future. You know, maybe costs come down, maybe efficiencies improve. I hope they do. But for the short term, that's a great outcome. Great news.
Ben Piker is a Northern Tasmanian salmon farm co-owner. Well, now, Tarek, weekly wrap of livestock prices and the sheep and lamb job. Well, it's strong, but as Tim McRae from Auctions Plus explains, the cattle market is not letting up either.
No, every time I look at it and it's a new record, you take a breath and go, surely it can't go higher. But this week, you got up to 910 cents, and it was only in the last quarter of last year where it got above 800. So, amazing prices. Really does, you know, factor in the excellent season we're having. But amazingly, the young cattle keep coming. We saw very big numbers online this week, and some of the physical yards have seen some very good numbers. That hasn't put a dampener on prices at all. Buyers continue to reach now very deeply into their pockets to secure some good lines heading into the winter.
And that's their restock and demand mainly, you think?
Yeah, certainly the restock of them, and there's a lot of grass in paddocks. Very interestingly, this week we saw some initially low clearance rates in our auctions, but in the 2 to 3 days after the auctions closed, a lot of deals were done, and that was with particularly the sellers reducing their reserves to be able to clear the lines. So I think that does show there's a bit of buyer hesitancy. They couldn't go much higher. But also those with cattle that are ready to be sold are very happy to be cashing in at this level of the market.
Okay, and what's been happening in the sheep and lamb market?
Steady as she goes, the sheep and lamb market. It used to be the star of the high prices, and it was all about record lamb prices. But cattle captured that attention recently. But look, you know, we saw 90,000 head online, some very good numbers through the physical yards. First cross ewe lambs were up $42 a head this week, averaging 250, but particularly on the breeding lines, the Scandian lamb merino ewes and the Scandian lamb first cross ewes, they were both down this week, but some pretty big numbers. But again, they sold for $258 and $311 each. So some very good prices again for breeding stock, and that just feeds back into the, whether it's cattle or sheep at the moment, there's a rebuild going on.
But also there's still strong demand in the Middle East as well for sheep and lamb, so and that sort of that must be underpinning the market too.
The demand side of the equation is very good. I mean, it's been, the dollar has been pretty steady now for a few weeks, which is very nice given there's been a few international things going on. But look, you know, particularly on the lamb side, it's always the case that there's very few competitors and Australian lamb is very highly sought after. So we don't see that export demand going anywhere soon.
And the fact that we've had a spell of dry weather, people aren't worried?
No, I think. I think it's been a very nice April for a lot of areas to dry out. I think it's going to be our driest month for a few regions in a long time. But I think it really does enable producers to both be getting cattle into market, which we've seen, but also that traditional cropping and preparation time has taken over. But conditions still pretty good on the whole.
Tim McRae from Auctions Plus. So let's go to the market information for Griffith Sheep and Lambs, and here's Graham Richard.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers eased to 3,750 and the quality was good through the heavy lambs, a little mixed on the lighter weights. Heavy lambs were best supplied and there was a small run of merinos and dorpers. Lambs 20 to 24 kilos were 5 to 7 cheaper with the plainer quality and they ranged between 164 and 197 to average around 790 cents. The heavy lambs were back $4, 190 to 242 or 750 cents on average and the extra heavies over 30 kilos 237 to 284. Trade merinos 166 to 198 and they topped at 215 and dorpers reached 220. Mutton numbers also fell and the quality was mixed, prices 3 to 5 cheaper, the medium weights 131 to 184, heavy merino ewes 161 to 210 and crossbred weathers reached 213. And this has been Graham Richard at Griffith.
And that's the market information for today and the program for today and for the week. We'll be back on Monday, though, between 12 and 1 on the Country Hour. We'll talk to you then.